Imagine being a master chef. Like, you've run kitchens for years. You know exactly how to balance these really complex flavor profiles. And you've fed, thousands of happy people.
Right, you have all this incredible validated experience.
Exactly. But then you move to a new city and you can't even get a job at a local diner.
Because you don't have that one very specific locally issued piece of paper.
Yeah. This paper that supposedly proves you know how to boil water. It's wild. You don't need to relearn how to cook, you know. You just need to figure out how to navigate the local bureaucracy to prove you already know what you're doing.
It's a profoundly frustrating position to be in, and yet it is the exact reality for thousands of highly qualified professionals around the world right now.
Yeah, it really is.
You have the baseline competence, but you are completely locked out because, well, you lack the system's preferred method of validation.
And that is exactly why we are here today. Welcome to this deep dive. I'm your host, and today we are handing you, the listener, a survival guide for that very specific, very maddening professional journey.
It's a really important topic.
It is. We are going to explore the ultimate evolution of an educator. So first, we're unpacking how to aggressively validate your hard-earned skills to break through that systemic gatekeeping.
Right, getting your foot in the door.
Exactly. And second, once you actually get past those gates, how do you transform from a recognized professional into a truly impactful leader?
And to do this, we are synthesizing two very different, but I think deeply complementary sources today.
Yeah, they pair together surprisingly
You
well.
really do. So the first is a highly strategic kind of boots on the ground guide for overseas teachers trying to navigate the UK's assessment only route.
Right, the AO route to gain qualified teacher status or QTS.
Exactly. It is a masterclass in cutting through institutional red tape. And then the second source, it zooms out a bit. It's a deeply personal professional reflection.
It's a fascinating read, honestly.
It is, yeah. It explores what happens when you merge transformational leadership with Robert Greenleaf's principles of servant leadership.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Our mission today is to decode the bureaucracy of proving your worth, and then to figure out the daily practical habits that elevate you from just being, good at your job to being a great leader of people.
Because whether you are an international teacher trying to get your credentials recognized, or say a corporate manager trying to prove your value after a merger,
Oh, that's a great comparison.
right, the underlying mechanics of owning your narrative and leading with empathy, they're completely universal.
They really are.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the skill set required to bypass a bureaucratic system and the skill set required to lead a team are actually driven by the exact same engine.
Okay, how so?
Well, both require a really deep understanding of institutional psychology. You have to anticipate roadblocks, understand the fears of the people across the table from you, and communicate your value in a way that solves their problems.
That makes total sense. So let's start with the immediate hurdle, which is just getting your foot in the door. Our first source paints a really vivid picture of the friction overseas teachers face.
It's significant friction, yeah.
Yeah, you hit this massive wall of gatekeeping. And when you look for a ladder to get over the wall, you end up on these online forums. They're basically just like black holes of doom scrolling.
Oh, absolutely. It's just conflicting advice and people telling you it's impossible.
Exactly. Just total negativity.
And that is the natural byproduct of an information vacuum. When an institutional system is overly complex, misinformation just rushes in to fill the void.
Right.
And what the source does so well is dismantle the systemic myths that are actively paralyzing applicants. Like, there's this pervasive, highly damaging narrative that if you move to a new country, your past experience is functionally worthless.
Which is just crazy to me.
Right. The myth is that you must completely redo your initial teacher training.
Which, again, is wild. Being told you need to redo your foundational training is like, well, it's like being told you have to retake your driving test in a new country just because the steering wheel is on the right side of the car.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Like, even though you've been driving perfectly for a decade, you already understand the rules of the road, the physics of the vehicle, how to anticipate traffic. You just need a mechanism to demonstrate that you can adapt your existing expertise to the local conditions.
That analogy hits the nail on the head because it really highlights the difference between learning a skill and translating a skill.
Translating. I like that word for it.
Yeah, because the assessment-only route, the AO route, it's designed specifically for translation. If you have completed initial training in your home country and have a solid couple of years of post-training experience, The source makes it clear you are likely already eligible.
You don't need to start from scratch.
Exactly. You don't need to spend thousands of pounds and, you know, a year of your life sitting in university lectures learning how to write a basic lesson plan.
But the misinformation goes way deeper than just the training aspect, right?
Yeah.
Because even if people realize they don't have to go back to university, they get hit with the second wave of panic.
Yes. The policy expert myth.
Right. The belief that you must be a walking encyclopedia of UK educational policy. They think if they can't quote the latest government white paper on curriculum reform, they'll just be disqualified.
And this raises a really important question about what these assessments are actually looking for. The AO route is not a trivia test on British legislative acronyms.
Thank goodness for that.
Right. It is a behavioral assessment. You merely need to demonstrate that your daily practical teaching meets the UK teacher's standards.
So it's about what you actually do in the room.
Precisely. Assessors are looking for pedagogical impact, like, are your students safe? Are they learning? And are you adapting to their needs? Good teaching is recognizable across borders.
Yeah. Good teaching is just good teaching.
Exactly. You don't need to speak in policy jargon. You just need to provide evidence of effective practice.
It's the ultimate show, don't tell scenario.
Well,
you don't write a theoretical essay about behavior management. You just show a log of how you successfully de-escalated a real classroom situation.
Which is a much more accurate measure of skill anyway.
Definitely. Which brings us to a really interesting psychological barrier mentioned in the source. Because this route bypasses the traditional university structure, people just assume it must be exponentially harder to pass.
What's fascinating here is how people conflate the word harder with more independent.
Oh, that's a key distinction.
It really is. The actual standard of teaching required to pass isn't higher than any other route. The friction comes from the complete lack of handholding.
Because you're totally on your own.
Right. In a traditional university program, you have a pre-built schedule, you know, professors setting deadlines, a cohort of peers to lean on. The AO route strips all of that away.
You are the project manager of your own qualification.
Exactly. If you don't schedule the observation, it doesn't happen. If you don't map your evidence to the standards, no one does it for you.
So, if the truth about this streamlined route is out there, that it's not necessarily harder, just more independent, why are these myths so persistent? Why did people always default to the hardest, most expensive path?
It largely comes down to institutional inertia.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, these myths aren't usually spread maliciously. They are perpetuated by well-meaning school administrators and HR departments who simply haven't been trained on the alternative routes.
Ah, so they just recommend what they know.
Exactly. They recommend the traditional university path because it's a known quantity. It's safe. And this highlights a crucial takeaway for you, the listener.
Which is?
When you are navigating a complex bureaucracy, you cannot rely on staff room hearsay or the default knowledge of middle management. You have to become the undisputed expert on your own career pathway.
Which flows perfectly into the actual mechanics of validation. Let's say you've done the independent research. You know the myths are fake, but the system still isn't just going to take your word for it.
No, definitely not.
You can't just walk up to the gatekeeper and say, hey, trust me, my old head teacher thought I was great. You have to build an airtight, irrefutable case.
Precisely. And the source outlines a very deliberate six-step strategy for this, starting with a ruthless self-audit.
Step one.
Right. Step one. Before you even contact an assessment provider, you have to verify the hard metrics. Do you have whole class teaching responsibility? Do you have the equivalent of GCSEs in core subjects like maths, English, and science?
Because if you don't meet those baseline specs, it's a non-starter.
Exactly. No amount of brilliant teaching will override the foundational bureaucracy.
Okay, so once you've cleared that baseline, the real work begins. And from reading the source material, it seems like the entire process hinges on one massive undertaking.
The digital portfolio.
Yes, the portfolio. You weren't just sending over a resume here. You are building a comprehensive digital archive of your entire professional existence.
The portfolio is the mechanism of translation we talked about earlier, but the biggest mistake applicants make is treating this portfolio like a digital dumping ground.
Just dragging and dropping files.
Yes. They just upload 100 random lesson plans and worksheets into a Google Drive and expect the assessor to figure it out. You have to think of this more like curating a museum exhibit.
Right, a museum exhibit has a narrative. You don't just throw dinosaur bones in a pile in the middle of the room, you know. You arrange them so they tell a clear story of evolution.
That's a brilliant way to look at it. every single artifact you upload, whether it's a sequence of lesson plans, a student's graded essay, or a log of your professional development, must be explicitly annotated.
You have to spell it out for them.
Exactly. You annotate it to show exactly how it fulfills a specific bullet point of the teacher's standards. You are doing the cognitive work for the assessor. You are making it impossible for them to say no because the evidence is meticulously categorized.
But building that museum exhibit, I mean, that takes months of meticulous work, usually while you're already working a really demanding full-time job.
It's exhausting.
The source calls out the sheer psychological friction of this phase. People start with super high energy, but by week six, when they have 90 papers to grade and parent-teacher conferences to prep for, the portfolio just dies on the vine.
Motivation is entirely unreliable for a project of this scale. You just can't count on it.
So what's the fix?
The source offers a brilliantly simple countermeasure. Abandon the idea of massive, weekend-long work sprints. Instead, block out one non-negotiable hour a week.
Just 1 hour.
Just 1 hour. It leverages the power of compound effort. Consistent momentum prevents the project from feeling overwhelming. And it completely bypasses that guilt cycle of constantly procrastinating big blocks of work.
And it also helps quiet the imposter syndrome, right? Which the source flags as another major roadblock in this process.
Oh, absolutely.
Because when you are sitting alone at a computer, constantly comparing your past work to a new formal set of standards, that nagging voice creeps in, like, does my international experience actually count? Was I really doing it right?
That imposter syndrome is just a symptom of the translation process. The answer the source provides is an emphatic yes.
Your experience is valid.
Your student growth counts. Your ability to manage a classroom counts. The mechanics of human learning do not change when you cross a border. You simply have to reframe your past successes through the vocabulary of your new target system.
But here is a massive friction point I want to dig into. Let's say you do everything right. You check the boxes, you build the perfect curated portfolio. The final step is getting your current school to formally sponsor and support your application.
Right, because assessors need to come observe you in a live classroom.
Exactly. But the source warns that schools often push back on this. So what does this all mean? If a school gets a fully legally qualified teacher at the end of the process, why on earth would they resist supporting the application? It sounds like a total win-win.
It seems counterintuitive until you look at it through the lens of institutional anxiety.
Okay, break that down for me.
Schools, and really any large organization, operate on a scarcity mindset regarding time and resources. When a head teacher or a department head hears the word assessment, they don't picture a win-win. They picture a massive administrative burden.
They just see paperwork.
They imagine their senior staff losing dozens of hours to mentoring, filling out compliance forms, and managing external assessors walking through their halls.
They see you as a new problem on their desk.
Exactly. So to overcome this, the applicant has to fundamentally change their approach. You have to pivot from acting like a subordinate asking for a favor to acting like a strategic partner offering a solution.
You manage upward.
You manage upward. You proactively present the AO route to your leadership by emphasizing that it's a light touch assessment. You explain that you have already curated the evidence, that it requires minimal mentoring compared to traditional routes, and that you will manage all the logistics.
You have to dismantle their anxiety before they even have a chance to articulate it. Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Let's say you do exactly that. You navigate the gatekeepers, you manage your head teacher's anxiety, you pass the assessment, and you get your QTS.
You are officially validated.
Yes. You've proven you meet the baseline standards. But our deep dive today doesn't end there, because proving you belong in the building is just playing defense.
Right?
How do you shift to playing offense? How do you transition from a professional who merely meets the standards to a leader who redefines them for everyone else?
Getting the qualifications simply means you've mastered the mechanics of your job. True excellence requires mastering the human element.
And this is where we transition to our second source.
Yes, which explores a fascinating professional evolution. The author reflects on shifting their practice toward transformational leadership, but specifically grounding it in Robert Greenleaf's 10 Principles of Servant Leadership.
And this is such a vital distinction to make, because transformational leadership on its own is often highly charismatic, right?
Occasionally, yeah.
It's about a leader with a grand vision rallying the troops. But that can sometimes turn into a massive ego trip or lead to burnout if the team just feels like tools being used to achieve the leader's personal vision.
Yes, and that is exactly why injecting Greenleaf's principles is so powerful. servant leadership fundamentally inverts the traditional power dynamic.
Okay, how so?
Instead of the team existing to serve the leader's goals, the leader exists to remove obstacles and accelerate the growth of the team.
That's a huge mindset shift.
It is. When you merge that with a transformational vision, you get a leadership style that is highly ambitious, but deeply human-centered. It adds an ethical, supportive dimension to chasing high performance.
Let's look at the actual principles the source outlines, because they're not what you typically find in a corporate management seminar.
No, they're quite different.
We're talking about active listening, empathy, healing and humility, self-awareness, persuasion, conceptualization, foresight, stewardship, commitment to the growth of people, and building community.
Notice what is missing from that list.
Yeah, what stands out to you?
There is nothing about command, control, compliance, or asserting authority. Every single principle is relational. They require the leader to be intensely attuned to the psychological state of the people around them.
And I love that the source material doesn't just leave these as abstract philosophical concepts, you know.
Right, the reflection log.
Yes. The author actually provides a reflection log, this gritty, brutally honest look at their own good versus bad practices in the actual trenches of daily leadership.
It brings the theory right down to reality.
It really does. Let's explore a few of these, starting with the failures, because those are often the most instructive.
Well, let's look at the intersection of self-awareness and active listening. In the reflection log, the author notes a bad practice. Interrupting a trainee teacher mid-explanation during a feedback session simply because the leader assumed they already knew what the trainee was going to say.
Ouch.
Or ignoring their own personal stress signals until it bled into their tone of voice and negatively affected the whole classroom environment.
We have all been on both sides of that interaction, honestly. You're rushed, you're trying to be efficient, so you just cut someone off to get to the solution faster.
But by doing that, you completely destroy the other person's agency.
Exactly. You solve the immediate problem, but you create long-term disengagement.
And that contrasts sharply with the good practice they noted in the log. Actively recognizing a personal tendency to dominate meetings and consciously forcing themselves to step back, sit in the silence, and let quieter voices contribute.
That level of self-regulation is incredibly difficult.
It is, but it's how you actually build a community.
What about the tension between persuasion and authority? Because, I mean, as a newly minted, fully qualified professional, there is a real temptation to finally flex that authority. You've earned it, right?
Oh, the temptation is huge. And the source illustrates this beautifully. The bad example was a leader attempting to force a new policy change, like rolling out a new digital teaching tool, by simply pointing to their job title and demanding compliance.
Do because I'm the boss.
Exactly. They didn't listen to the team's concerns about workload or implementation, which instantly generated resentment and quiet quitting.
Right.
The good practice was the leader taking the time to trial the tool themselves, demonstrate its tangible benefits to the team's daily workflow, and building genuine buy-in.
Positional power might force compliance for a week, but persuasion is the only thing that produces actual commitment.
Exactly. And that flows directly into foresight and empathy. A leader failing in this area was described as dismissing a trainee who completely bombed an observation by casually saying it was just nerves rather than digging into the root cause.
Or brushing it off.
Yeah. Or worse, being so obsessed with sticking to a conceptual lesson plan that they completely missed a student exhibiting clear signs of emotional trauma.
It's the danger of managing the spreadsheet instead of leading the human beings in front of you.
Perfectly said. The successful counterpart to that was the leader using foresight to anticipate a team member's stress bottleneck, like noticing that grading was piling up, and proactively adjusting their workload before the person had a breakdown.
It's seeing the iceberg before the ship hits it and actually caring enough to change course.
Yes.
Okay, I want to push back on one of these principles, though, because it feels a little counterintuitive to the entire first half of our deep dive.
Okay, let's hear it.
I'm looking at the healing and humility principle. The author explicitly reflects on a moment where they mediated a conflict between staff members by openly admitting that they, the leader, had messed up the scheduling.
Right, taking the blame.
Doesn't showing that much vulnerability, like openly admitting a mistake, make a leader look weak? Especially after you have just spent months building this irrefutable portfolio to prove exactly how competent you are.
It is a very common fear. We are conditioned to believe that leadership requires this illusion of flawless competence. But organizational psychology and the source's own reflection reveal the exact opposite. Yes. Humility is actually the ultimate accelerant for trust.
How does admitting a flaw build trust, though?
Because it creates psychological safety. When a leader admits a mistake, they are publicly modeling a growth mindset. They are communicating to the team that errors are inevitable learning opportunities, not fatal character flaws that are going to be punished.
Oh, okay. I see.
If you try to maintain an aura of perfection, you inadvertently create a culture of fear. Your team will start hiding their own mistakes, which leads to catastrophic systemic failures down the line. By acknowledging your own missteps, you transition from being an unapproachable judge to being a collaborative partner.
That makes a lot of sense.
Paradoxically, vulnerability from a position of authority produces massive loyalty and engagement.
So by saying, hey, I dropped the ball on the schedule, you give everyone else in the room permission to be human.
Exactly.
And a team of humans who aren't terrified of making mistakes is instantly more innovative and resilient than a team paralyzed by perfectionism.
Precisely. It is the ultimate playing offense move. You are sacrificing your short-term ego to invest in the long-term culture of your team.
Wow. This has been such a massive, fascinating journey today. We started with a literal strategic roadmap for hacking through bureaucratic gatekeeping.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. We looked at how overseas professionals can use the assessment-only route to validate their past experience, dismantling the myths of having to start over, learning to curate a museum-quality digital portfolio, and, you know, successfully managing institutional pushback from their own schools.
And then we transitioned into what you actually do with that validation. We explored a blueprint for shaping the future using Robert Greenleaf's principles of servant leadership.
Moving past the mechanics of compliance.
Right, moving into the art of transformation, where your primary metric of success is how effectively you elevate the people around you.
Moving from proving your own worth to multiplying the worth of others.
And the unifying thread running through every single concept we've discussed today is intentionality.
Intentionality, yes.
Whether you are meticulously mapping a lesson plan to a bureaucratic standard to prove you belong, or you are sitting in a chaotic staff meeting, consciously practicing active listening instead of interrupting, you are in control.
You have to be deliberate about it.
You are actively authoring your professional narrative rather than letting a rigid system or just a stressful afternoon dictate it for you.
You are building your own doors when the gates are closed. Which brings me back to the very beginning of our deep dive. We've spent the second half of this conversation talking about servant leadership as a framework for managing your team, your trainees, or your students.
Right.
But consider the gatekeepers in your own life right now. The administrators, the assessors, the middle managers standing between you and that next validation.
The people holding the keys.
Exactly. What if the very empathy, the foresight, and the active listening required of a servant leader are the exact same psychological tools you need to successfully persuade those gatekeepers?
Oh, that's interesting.
What if treating the bureaucracy with empathy is actually the secret to decoding it?
That is a profound way to look at it.
Yeah.
You aren't just fighting the gatekeepers. You are leading them to your solution.
Something to chew on as you start curating your own portfolio. Thank you for joining us on this journey. Until next time, keep diving deep.